This week's episode of Extra Serving is sponsored by Smithfield. No menu is complete without the big three of breakfast: bacon, breakfast sausage, and ham. That's why Smithfield partnered with an esteemed group of chefs from across the food service landscape to discuss the possibilities of the big three breakfast proteins, as well as offer insights, ideas, and recipes that we are excited to pass on to you. Visit SmithfieldMorningsAndMore.com. That is SmithfieldMorningsAndMore.com. Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Extra Serving, a podcast by The Last Bite Network, a production of Nation's Restaurant News and Restaurant Hospitality. I'm your host, Holly Petrie, here with this week's episode. But here is some housekeeping first from The Last Bite Network. This week, Takeaway with Sam Okus aired an episode with Subway president Trevor Haynes, where they discussed the story of how the brand rolled out its latest menu update, Eat Fresh Refresh. Very tricky to say, so hope I got it right. This week's episode of In the Kitchen with Brett Thorne featured Death & Co. co-founder Ravi DeRossi on finding new purpose in the wake of the pandemic. Now he is not a chain, but he is a group of vegan bars and restaurants. And Brett and Ravi discuss his entire history. It's very interesting. I highly recommend it. Now that the housekeeping is over, I can introduce my two lovely colleagues who have joined me today.
I am Sam Okus, editor-in-chief of Nation's Restaurant News.
And I'm Ron Ruggles, senior editor with Nation's Restaurant News.
Yay, Ron is here.
Yay, Ron.
Yay.
Glad to join you today.
I try to be happy when
and
we get
people on
guests.
The podcast. And people on the cast don't realize I can see you as well, which is a real luxury.
Oh, yeah. Well, my hair is looking good today. So very good.
Let's not get into the hair conversation again. I thought we already agreed that would be a cutting room floor.
We did have a whole hair conversation before we started recording. So
maybe we should have a live poll. Who has prettier hair right now, Sam, Holly, or Ron?
I mean, I think we can all agree.
Who sounds like maybe they have prettier hair?
Ron, it's obviously you.
Yeah.
Thank you. He says as he flips his hair.
All right. Getting into the news today, we had earnings city. So we had earnings this week from Cheesecake Factory, Wingstop, Bloomin' Brands, Dine Brands, Papa John's, Chili's, Ruth's Chris, Texas Roadhouse, and Starbucks. Felt like I was doing a little rap there. And then, so some of the big things that came out of this earnings season, this week of extreme earnings, we had some brands that are up year over 2 years. Wingstop and Papa John's, who were also up year over year, saw incredible sales during the pandemic and now are still up. Starbucks is up year over 2 years. Some brands were really impacted by labor, like Brinker and Texas Roadhouse, and some brands were impacted by the supply chain, like Ruth's Chris. So, time for an analysis from the experts. What do you guys think?
Ron, you were really close to this. Why don't you start?
I sent a lot of calls and I agree with the folks who almost universally said this is the toughest time ever in the restaurant business, but probably a time of the biggest change in the restaurant business. So I think we're sitting in a very interesting spot right now to watch everything that's going on.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, when you certainly from the perspective of, I know with like Ruth's Chris in particular and Texas Roadhouse, like watching the supply issue really, they're really fighting this issue right now from a standpoint of cost and things like that. But, you know, I would just flag a couple of things that jumped out. You know, for starters, Papa John's continuing to grow their sales after an insane year last year. When you remember, we just talked about Domino's, I think last week, that Domino's sales were down, but with the caveat because they were up so high in 2020. And now for Papa John's to be so up so high in 2020 and to continue to be up That is just really impressive. And, you know, two things for them that they credited were innovation with their epic stuffed crust pizza, but then also their loyalty program. So, you know, there's a lot you can kind of pick apart and learn from some of these results. But, you know, just the fact that they haven't let off the accelerator, they're still innovating and still pushing with their loyalty program is clearly paying dividends. The other results I would point to are the performance at the casual chains like Cheesecake Factory and Brinker. You know, I think what I've had this conversation with a lot of people recently, which is I feel like casual dining is going to come out of the pandemic, perhaps the strongest or perhaps a so-called winner. You know, the fast casual and the delivery, the pizza and chicken wing, they all were the quote unquote winners in the thick of the pandemic. But when you think about the new muscle that casual dining brands have developed over the pandemic and they're starting to flex, right? So, you know, Cheesecake Factory and Chili's talking about how much off-premises continues to be a win for them. I just think about that in terms of, you know, all those casual dining chains that I wouldn't go to because I don't want to sit in there with my kids and, you know, go through an hour and a half of having to, you know, get my kids to just draw on your thing, use the crayons, please just stop yelling and having to pay, you know, a lot more money because maybe we stay for a couple of drinks, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, the fact that I could get them for delivery now, you know, this is what these chains are figuring out. They've opened up to a whole new clientele. And so anyway, I just wanted to flag that because I just think it's fascinating to watch. We were basically sounding the death knell for casual dining a year ago. And now to watch is they're really, you know, really ramping up.
And there's interest. I was did a preparatory call with Christine Barone of True Food Kitchen. And she said a big benefit of casual dining is the fact that they have seats. QSR and fast casual came out of the 2008 recession, really. I mean, that's when it took its boom. You think you're going to see a major change at this point where QSR is going to find that their NLs have shown that they don't really need that many seats or that much square footage to seed in sales. And a lot of that traffic, if you want to go dine out, goes to casual dining, where people can sit down. And I think 30%, 20% of their sales are now off-premise, and they're keep maintaining those seats for people to go to. So I think you're going to see in the next year and a half, a major change in casual dining and how it markets and attracts customers.
One of the things I found so interesting is that Wingstop was also another brand that was still up. I mean, I couldn't imagine them. How are there this many people that are still eating? Like, how can they still have sales that are up? There's a wing shortage. They're still up in sales. I mean,
and their delivery's up too, right? Isn't their delivery up over last year? Like, everybody was doing delivery last year and somehow their delivery's still up. Now, I think with Wingstop, remember, they set a goal for themselves a couple of years ago that they wanted to be 100% digital sales. So I think with a company like that, you know, that this has all been a part of their strategy all along. And so I think they're really pushing into the, you know, let's direct customers to delivery because that works really well for our business model. So I would expect that to continue to go up as they strive for that 100% digital order goal.
And they're succeeding there. A lot of their dining rooms have not reopened. They're still making these sales gains by keeping their dine-in closed. So it's delivery, carry out, pickup. It's amazing how they've been able to maintain those sales.
Now I'm curious, Sam, since you've done this takeout from at like an Applebee's or a casual dining, you don't need to name the casual dining spot. will be nice. But what is delivery like from them? I'm curious how the food is traveling, how you're getting the delivery. Because usually you don't picture them as, obviously, we were just talking about it. You don't picture these brands as to-go brands.
And it's not always pretty. I mean, you know, and thankfully doing what I do, I know well enough to not to blame the brand, but maybe the delivery service. Because yeah, look, like I always know there's a trade-off. If I'm going to do, you know, DoorDash, Grubhub, Uber Eats, if I'm going to do one of those services and I'm going to get from a casual dining brand, I am not expecting it to be as high quality of a meal as if I sat down and had it there. But that's a trade-off I'm willing to make because I can stay in my home and I can, you know, deal with, you know, my kids can eat and run around the house and be crazy here. So, but it leaves something to be desired. And I think this is where the industry continues to know they need to they need to figure out what's going to make this work. Because a year ago, and even some into today, I think customers are willing to say, okay, well, I didn't want to go out and eat in person anyway, so I accept the fact that maybe it's going to be some soggy fries. That's not always going to be the case. They're not going to cut you that break forever. And again, that might be a third-party delivery solve that needs to happen, but the brands need to do some work around packaging, around timing. There's a real science to it. So, so long as customers can take it, then they're, you know, then you can slip by, but we're not going to have that luxury forever.
And I'm seeing more casual dining brands start to think about self-delivery. P.F. Chang's has been discussing it recently. They've created To-Go to be near their consumer. Now they're looking at taking that last mile in-house. So I think you're going to see more brands try to adopt that and save the 15 to 30% that they're paying third-party platforms now.
Ron, you've been doing a fair amount of dining in at some casual dining chains as well. What has your experience been like? I mean, we don't have casual dining chains here in New York, so I'm at least in the city. So I'm very curious to hear both of your experiences.
I actually last night went to Applebee's. I hadn't been to Applebee's in some time. I wanted to try the Bermond Street steak because it's so popular in culture right now. So I did that, but it was kind of depressing. It was slow, service slow, and half of the restaurant was chairs stacked on tables with parts cordoned off. They are having problems with staff, and you know, I'm certainly willing to put up with that, but it's also very depressing going into a place where it looks like it's under construction.
I feel like I need to first start by pointing out that I think every episode of Extra Serving, Holly finds a way to make the rest of us feel like commoners if we don't live in New York, and somehow she just has it so great there in New York. But anyway,
I'm just the queen bee. What can I say?
Yeah, right. That anyway. Yeah, I mean, look, I have not seen anything to that degree that you saw, Ron, at Applebee's, but I'm definitely when I dine in person. Way slower service times for sure. And then whenever I do road trips with my family, you know, definitely the drive-through lines are way longer than normal. And so for sure, we're seeing those pressures at a labor standpoint that this is really affecting. Now, the last three restaurant visits I have been on, though, have been sit at your table, scan the QR code, do the ordering from there, and they'll bring out your food. And folks, please let this be the future, because from a service standpoint, two of those places were casual dining, one was fast casual, and it worked like a charm at both of them. And it's so funny. We've talked about this. I think Holly, you and I talked about this the other day, that QR codes were total. Did I say QSR codes earlier? Oh, my brain is like getting fried. QR codes were like so 10 years ago, right? Like that for a hot sec, we all thought they were the future, and then nobody did them. And all of a sudden they come roaring back, and guess what? They are so great to just sit down, pull the menu, do the order, facilitate the payment right there. I think they were ahead of their time 10 years ago. We all thought they would be the future. And now, you know, they're very much, people are much more plugged into how this works. So I'm just throwing that out there as far as like, if you're having a labor issue, consider this. If you're not already, consider that service model, because you can pull out the table service and really streamline things.
The other side of QR codes, BJ's restaurants reported on its earnings call that they're going to the printed menus because they find people spend more when they order from the printed menu, 70 cents per average check, which was interesting. So I think it kind of depends on your audience. If you have a younger audience, they may be more acceptable to QR codes. I was encountered last night. I pulled up Applebee's menu on the QR code. But the table had two stickers, one for applying for a job and the other for the menu. So it was a bit confusing. I almost applied for a job at Applebee's.
And you got it. And this is your last episode of Extra Serving.
Yes. Thank you, guys. We'll see you next week.
I have no appropriate transition into this next story. So I'm not even going to try. But this week, Fazoli's was acquired. Pretty big news. Fat Brands is on a buying streak, really a streak. I mean, they've they've acquired a lot since they made the announcement that they were going to start to begin acquiring new brands slowly, but this is not slow. This is very quick. So what do we think about Fazoli's being added to the Fat Brands portfolio?
This is something you see in the restaurant business, and I've been covering the restaurant business for a long time. People do portfolios and they divest portfolios. They create portfolios and divest portfolios. It'll be interesting to see how they perform, Fazoli's performs under the Fat Brands umbrella. I think that's going to be, you know, it's almost like private equity buying up different brands and then spinning them off. It'll be interesting to see where Fazoli's goes under Fat Brand ownership.
Yeah, it is interesting because, you know, when you look at a lot of the targets for these Fat Brand acquisitions, it's a lot of value-oriented brands, which is, you know, not a bad thing. I mean, I think the Fazoli's that has done a pretty impressive job in the last decade of updating this brand and focusing on the fact that it is a value Italian chain. And that's done very well for them. But yeah, when you look at a lot of these acquisitions, Fat Brands is targeting some of those brands that equally are on this sort of value footing. You know, we're not talking about like the hot upstart fast casual. We're talking about brands that have been around for a while and, you know, have a solid value proposition. But clearly what Fat Brands is after here is scale. I mean, they continue to add, you know, 100, 200 unit chain here, 100, 200 unit chain there, but they're building quite the behemoth that they're going to be able to operate as something really much bigger than, you know, that the sum of its parts is going to be a lot. There's going to be a lot more potential, I guess, for that than the individual brands themselves. And so that's fascinating to watch because look, yeah, I mean, to Ron's point, this is something that has happened, you know, since the beginning of time for restaurants, but this is happening very fast. And I think I remember, you know, last year when we talked about like, I had lots of conversations with folks like, there's going to be a feeding frenzy in acquisitions just because of what the pandemic has done to this industry. Fat Brands, I think they saw that too. And so they said, well, let's go, let's do this. So really interesting to watch. Stay tuned for our December issue. Joanna Fantozzi, our colleague, is going to have a little bit more on that in the December issue because we just want to know like what's going on here and what kind of strategy, you know, what should we expect from a strategy like this? And should others pay attention? I'd also just drop in really quick. I will be in Las Vegas next week for the Restaurant Finance and Development Conference. If you're going to be there, please give me a shout, email me, we can connect. But I wanted to bring that up because I'm really fascinated to see, you know, from the finance standpoint of things, like where do we stand? Because, you know, and Ron, you can speak to all these IPOs we've been seeing, a record year really for IPOs. Talk about emerging restaurant chains looking for capital and these equity groups out there that are ready to pounce on some growing emerging chains. There's just the environment right now. There's just a lot of money out there for the right players. And so I'll be interested to see that next week at that conference. But we're seeing it play out in real time too in the news. So Ron, you should talk about the IPOs because it's pretty crazy.
You bet. The scale of big groups with the supply chain problems that everybody is having, scale, I think, is going to be more important. The bigger buyers are going to be able to acquire or have more attention from supply chain when you have trouble getting to-go containers into your store. If you're a bigger player, you can say, wave your hand and they'll be more likely to help you out. IPOs have been amazing. This is, I think Sweetgreen has already said it's going to be coming out with its, which will make it the fifth this year. And Portillo's, which came out 3 weeks ago, is now trading between $25 and $51. It introduced at $20. So it's been a very good year for attracting, especially brands that are very lucrative, attracting IPO money. There's a lot of money sloshing around, trying to find somewhere to go where it'll pay some returns.
And now you interviewed the CEO of Portillo's this week for our podcast, Ron. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. In fact, it's great. He's a former P.F. Chang's executive who's now into the fast casual space. And the interview was fantastic in the fact that he really opened up about where Portillo's is going and what he sees for the future of the company. I found it fascinating.
Well, that's great. And we will all enjoy it. And it was right after they announced they opened on the stock exchange, correct?
Correct. It was, they just had their IPO. In fact, it was the first day and things are going very well and they've actually gone better since. So it's his look at the future, I think, is very interesting for folks to listen to.
Well, that's great. And we are all looking forward to it.
This week's episode of Extra Serving is sponsored by Smithfield. No menu is complete without the big three of breakfast: bacon, breakfast sausage, and ham. That's why Smithfield partnered with an esteemed group of chefs from across the food service landscape to discuss the possibilities of the big three breakfast proteins, as well as offer insights, ideas, and recipes that we are excited to pass on to you. Visit SmithfieldMorningsAndMore.com. That is Smithfield, mornings with an S, and more.com.
Yeah, look, so I'm Michael Osanloo, president and CEO of Portillo's. I'm thrilled to be here. Thanks for having me, Ron. Why is it a good time to have an IPO? I think if you are a company that is performing well, if you're a company with a great, vibrant culture, a great consumer following, I think it's the time for an IPO is kind of irrelevant if you're great at what you do. And I think that we are great at what we do. This is an amazing company. I'm privileged to be part of this, but we have unbelievable people in the front lines who just bust their butts every single day, taking great care of our guests. You know, we serve delicious, highly craveable food at a ridiculously sharp price point, right? The average person going to Portillo's spends $9.60 for delicious food served by great people in an inviting, warm atmosphere. For that company, it's always a good time for an IPO.
I was most startled by the number, I guess the average drive-through is like 4.9 million for a Portillo's unit.
Yeah, they're bust. We have, you know, and our drive-throughs, what's amazing is our drive-throughs are not like what most people expect or think of as a drive-through, right? So, because most people think of as a drive-through is you pull up, there's an order board, you order, maybe some AI interacts with you, you go to a window and pay another window and collect your food. That's not us, right? So when you go to Portillo's drive-through, there's two lanes of traffic. You have a human being come up to you and ask you what you want, and they help curate the menu. So if you order a beef sandwich, they're going to say, would you like sweet or hot peppers? You know why? Because it tastes better. It's an amazing experience to get those peppers on your sandwich. If you don't order a chocolate cake, they're going to tell you, by the way, we make chocolate cake in-house every single day. And I will tell you, it's the best darn chocolate cake you're ever going to have. So you should try it. But a human being helps you and curates your order for you. They put a little sticker on your window. And by the way, they collect payment right there. So there's a mobile POS device that we collect payment. They put a sticker on your window and the two lanes will merge into one. And then food runners run your food out to you. So Ron, if you ordered your food and you're stuck behind someone who had a little bit more complicated order, they'll bring your food out to you. You pop into that second lane and then you can leave. You don't have to wait for everybody else in front of you. Our drive-throughs do so well because of the way they're set up and the guest engagement. And so I love our drive-throughs. And I actually think it's one of the most, it's one of the best ways for a guest to experience a restaurant company is via the drive-thru.
And you are going to open a three-lane drive-thru or had plans. Is that still on the boards?
Yes. So we have a restaurant opening in Joliet, Illinois in first quarter of, 22. And that restaurant is a three-lane drive-thru only concept. There's no seating inside. It's meant to be a drive-thru. We're making it a highly branded experience, right? So you're going to see the Portillo's team members wearing NASCAR-looking pit crew outfits. There'll be a car coming out of the bushes. We want it to be an exceptional experience, and we want it to reflect our brand well. But we also want to take advantage of just so much demand near that restaurant that we have other restaurants that are bursting at the seams. So we want to take a little bit of pressure off of those. And of course, we're going to learn a lot. right? We'll see how this performs. We'll understand the economics of a drive-through only restaurant, and we'll see if there's opportunities to put more of those in, whether we're fortressing in Chicago or infill strategy outside of Chicago.
Interestingly, in this, since 1963, when Portillo started, no restaurants have closed.
Not one restaurant. I know, it's crazy, right? I've been in the restaurant industry. I don't know of another concept that can say that.
And why is that? What has been the strategy that has made that such a success?
I think, you know, it's a great question. I think it's the same question when people say, why do you have such high AUVs? It comes down to just do the fundamentals really well, right? We have amazing people. And I think that's like important, right? Amazing people who are so engaged. We have delicious food. Our food is unbelievably tasty. It's craveable. Everything you get at Portillo's is made to order. And so that's the second step. It's a ridiculously low price point. The average person spends $9.60 at Portillo's. And then it's in a beautiful, engaging environment. If you do all that stuff well, you have lots of day parts, lots of occasions. We have tremendous transaction volume. That is the key to success. Amazing people serving delicious food at a low price point in a great environment. It's actually not that complicated.
You mentioned AUVs. They're very high. What are they?
What we've shared with people is that our AUVs are right around $8.6 million per restaurant. It's a little bit higher in Chicagoland, a little bit lower outside Chicagoland, but no matter how you look at them, they're pretty impressive.
A decor package varies across the system. You have 67 units in 9 states, correct?
That's correct. Yes. Yes.
What can we anticipate for decor or atmosphere going forward?
I'm sorry, you froze the video, but I think is the question about atmosphere and decor going forward?
Yes. What can we anticipate or expect going forward?
So every one of our restaurants is cookie cutter in the sense that the kitchen layout is the exact same. The layout of the box exact same. We like the drive-through in a certain way. We've optimized the guts of the restaurant and how it operates, right? The motion, we want third-party delivery to park here, come in, get their food and get out. We have curbside that works really well. So we have built a restaurant that we think is ideal for where the puck is going in the restaurant industry. That said, we don't want to look like a Chicago restaurant that's popped into all these markets. We want the decor and the cosmetics to fit the local environment. So I'll give you a couple examples. We built a restaurant in Sterling Heights, Michigan that opened up earlier this year. It is a gorgeous restaurant. We call it our garage prototype. There's a Ford Model T hanging from the ceiling. There's a Chevy Corvette coming out of one of the walls. There's automotive iconography throughout the restaurant. It's an homage to the automotive industry, right? Why? Well, there's 3 automotive plants within 5 miles of our restaurant, right? It needs to fit the local environment. We opened a restaurant in Orlando, Florida, that is unlike any other restaurant we opened. It's still the diner concept, but it's got this aquamarine blue ceiling, a giant guitar in the ceiling with LED strings going across it. It is a fun, engaging environment with outdoor patios. It fits Orlando, Florida, right? We wouldn't build that in Chicago or other places. So we're going to build restaurants where the guts are all the same, but that the decor is an ideal representation of what the local environment is. And we try to customize the decor a little bit just for that restaurant. You know, I don't want to build a Portillo's restaurant that looks like every other. If you're in Orlando and you live near Lake Buena Vista, that's your restaurant and it's unique for you.
Your background before Portillo's, and how do you bring that experience to what you're doing now?
So my background before, you know, I was CEO of P.F. Chang's before this. Before that, I was running the grocery business at Kraft Foods. And I did, before that, I did M&A and strategy at Kraft Foods. I've been a consultant at Bain. I have a checkered past, Ron, but I would tell you that every level. We all do, right? I've been a lawyer, you know, I've done stuff. So I think that everything I've done in the past has actually gotten me to the point where I can be be successful in this role. I am fundamentally, I believe in servant leadership, right? In a way, my job is really easy. I just have to take care of my team. I have to put them in a position to succeed and remove obstacles from them. They in turn need to be in a position where we put all of our frontline team members in a position to be successful. I deeply believe this, right? And I've learned this in the past. I've learned the importance of people and culture. And so I'm going to be an evangelist for our culture. I'm going to protect it, nurture it. I'm going to make sure that the people on the front line feel the love and support from the senior management team, right? If you go to one of our restaurants and you have a great experience, it's not because of me or executive team. It's because of the person who smiled and took your order. It's because of the person who made your sandwich. It's the person at Expedite who pushed the sandwich with a fun rhyme. It's the person who made sure the dining room was clean and thanked you for visiting. Those people are the people that matter. And those people are the people that define our success.
Now that you're public, what do you see as the major challenges and the major benefits going forward?
I think the major challenge is to avoid being distracted, right? Because the truth is that the formula for our success is what I just described, and it's being maniacally focused on what got us here, right? Going public is not a destination. It's a first step in a journey. You know, for us, going public is great. I'm excited, but the next 10 to 12 quarters really matter. We want to be a great restaurant company, and that means meeting and beating our shareholders' expectations on a go-forward basis.
And the possible hurdles?
Distraction, Ron, right? Letting ourselves get distracted. I'm a huge believer in just do a couple things really, really well. Don't get distracted by all the other cha-cha-cha. Just do what you do and do it really well. I tell my team, like, we will celebrate tonight. We'll be fun. Tomorrow, we're back at work. And tomorrow is back to what got us here, which is just maniacally focusing on our teams and on execution.
You're at 67 units now. What do you anticipate for growth into 22 and 23?
Yeah, we've identified 7 restaurants for 22. We're going to open 2 in Arizona, 2 in Florida. We have 1 coming in Texas, which I'm really excited about, and then another restaurant in Michigan and Illinois. And then in 23, we're targeting 9 restaurants, and we feel really good about those.
And in those 2 years, Texas is a new market for you, correct?
Yes, it is.
Any other new markets planned?
Yeah, in 23, we're planning on going into Ohio. You know, it's part of that natural expansion across the Midwest is Ohio. And then Texas, I think, is, you know, I think I mentioned it, but it's the number one place we ship our food to. There's a lot of latent demand for us in Texas.
You have a big shipping of food as part of your business plan. How has that helped you in planning expansion?
It's exactly as you might think, right? I think that the shipping business, apart from just being a great little business, is actually a source of insight as to where there's latent demand for us, right? So it has informed decisions like going to Arizona, going to Florida, going to Texas. Those are 3 of the most important shipping markets for us. And it won't be surprising when you think about the underlying intuition, right? You know, as a Chicago-based company, at some point, every Chicagoan finally says, I'm done with the Chicago winter. We tap out. And when you do that, you go to warm weather environments like Florida, Arizona, and Texas. So we think there's a relatively significant Chicago diaspora that is in those states. And so we think there's latent brand demand for us in those states.
And last question for you, more industry-wide, what do you see as the most exciting things on the horizon for the restaurant industry in general?
Look, I think it's going to be kind of a perverse, weird answer. I think that the last 18 months has been so tumultuous that it has forced us as an industry to get better, smarter, more agile in dealing with exogenous factors and how to take care of our team members. I see more and more restaurant companies that are doing a great job of taking care of people. And so I think that this uh, uh, it it portends a renaissance for the restaurant industry over the next 4 or 5 years. Restaurant companies have gotten smarter and better, and I think we'll continue to perform exceptionally well over the next 5 years.